You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
4 years ago, various groups of Americans calling themselves the Tea Party found an ideal platform to air their ideas, the town hall meeting. The town halls, which were meant to open up the debate about health care reform, quickly became battlegrounds where ordinary Americans took up issues with their leaders face-to-face, and in some instances, they became media circuses. My next guests, Brooklyn-based filmmaker Sierra Pettengill and Jamila Wignott, took cameras into some of those meetings in central Pennsylvania and spent 2 years following two devoted activists in the lead-up to the 2012 election. Their film, called Town Hall, will be screened on November 17th and the 20th at the IFC Center as part of the Doc NYC Festival. And Sierra Pettengill and Jamila Wignott join me now to talk about it. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for
Sarah,
having us.
There was a lot of anger all along the political spectrum in 2009. Did you see the Tea Party movement as having a major impact or a potential impact on the upcoming presidential election?
I think we were a little less concerned with their impact at that moment. We were really taken aback by the amount of passion that was being shown in those meetings and sort of the hysteria surrounding them. And it felt like a very unusual group of people to go out and protest, you know, white middle class conservatives who you don't usually see in that space. And we were really curious as to what was motivating them and why that level of fear and anger was being expressed.
Well, Jamila, the town hall meetings became media circuses in many instances, both sides having a field day collecting sound bites. What didn't you like about the way the media were portraying the Tea Party?
I think we just felt like on both sides it was an oversimplification of the people that we were seeing. Certainly, you know, conservative media seemed to be heralding these people as new American heroes, while the left was sort of picking up, you know, the guy dressed as Benjamin Franklin or, you know, somebody with an incredibly racist sign. And it just seemed like there were just it was too large a swath of people who were coming out to these meetings. So we just felt nobody seemed to be getting at the true motivations, as Sierra was saying.
Although there was stereotyping within the movement as well. We'll get to that in a moment. But is that why you present everything without comment, using the fly-on-the-wall approach?
Yeah, I think we felt very strongly that the sort of best approach for us would be to meet a group of people and sort of let them speak for themselves, whether it was a kind of positive or negative takeaway. We would allow our audience to engage with them as much as they could.
Sarah, one of the people you follow is Katie Abram, who became viral on YouTube when, during a town hall meeting, she told Senator Arlen Specter that he had awakened the sleeping giant and that she didn't want this country to turn into Russia. Is that when you became aware of her?
Yeah, we started collecting sort of all of the most inflammatory town hall moments, and that was a big one.
Well, she was thrust into the national spotlight, hailed by some as a hero, but dismissed by others as someone who didn't know what she was talking about. And she had worked in broadcast news, hadn't she? How did she feel about the current state of the media?
Yeah, that's an interesting and complicated question. When she worked in broadcast news, she describes herself as having been a liberal at that point. And she left her job to raise her children and found herself in a very rural community, cut off from sort of any social interaction, and turned on talk radio and found sort of a voice through that.
But she was encouraged by her husband, who kept on telling her that all of her ideas were wrong.
Right. Yes, her story is not totally straightforward. But so she, I think she can sort of see a lot of good in all sorts of media outlets, but gravitates towards the conservative end of things by now.
Was she upset when Chris Matthews embarrassed her with a question about taxes on Hardball?
Yes.
Her finest moment.
Her finest moment. She will gladly admit to that. I mean, she didn't feel quite like she was ready for the spotlight. But I think, you know, what's interesting about her is her sense that she had to take this on. I mean, she feels very driven by a mission, and so I think her embarrassment in that moment is overrided by her feeling that she was kind of giving herself over fully to a cause.
Well, getting back to what you said earlier, why do you think the Tea Party protests attracted people who didn't always think of themselves as protesters?
Yes, also a very complicated question, one that Sierra and I didn't really have an answer to when we started, and that was kind of, you know, of course what we were aiming at. And I think we just realized that at the time that we started filming, and it's hard to remember now, I mean, you know, we were, you know, in the earliest sort of decade of the 21st century, we're a country who's confronting some of the, you know, largest problems that we'd faced in a while. And I think for most Americans, I think if you were on the left or the right in that moment, there was just this overwhelming sense of fear and a loss of control. And, you know, to them in that moment, it felt like at least just finding a space to voice and articulate those fears was very important. I mean, you see Katie actually later on in the film at an Occupy Harrisburg meeting where the same kind of energy is actually being displayed, but now by people on the left. And she kind of has the, you know, the capacity at least to see some connection between those fears, although, of course, they're, you know, the means to their ends are very different.
But both are populist movements.
Correct.
Your other main character is John, a baby boomer who held local office in the 1970s, and he says that politics is difficult, I'm quoting now, especially if you're an ideologue.
Yep.
So did the Tea Party movement or Tea Party ideas fit in with his ideology?
They did, and he was someone who I think was maybe more conservative than his sort of the national picture was for many years. And when the Tea Party sort of sprouted up, he saw a set of ideas that mapped onto his. And also he's pretty charismatic. He's a big personality, and he, you know, thought he could lead them. And to him, being an ideologue is, you know, we found that very funny that you would be a self-professed ideologue, but that's something he's very proud of, and that's why in the film, when he has to sort of confront the reality of his life as opposed to his ideology, it feels all the more sort of tragic.
The reality of his life being that his mother is seriously ill, and he can't afford to pay for her medical bills, and he's thinking, in fact, of leaving the country, going to the Philippines. But he may have to just rely on government help, something that is against all of his beliefs.
Right. And I think what's, you know, interesting about that moment is it's a real reflection of, I think, the limits of a kind of hyper-individualism that is also part of a Tea Party ideology, in which, you know, John's decision, while it sounds potentially laughable to people on the left to move to the Philippines, is one in which he's really taking control of his own destiny, and he's doing the best he can to take care of his mother without relying on state aid. And interestingly, when he realizes that that may be his only option, I think he has to, in a very human way, find a way to rationalize why he's able to do that, which is one in which he says to himself he deserved it. He earned this in a way that other Americans maybe haven't. So, you know, to us that was an interesting thing to see, you know, the inability of ordinary people to really confront their own contradictions.
And we felt that was something that's very universal, you know, that we all sort of have a set of ethics or a political system that we are trying to live up to. And it's, I know I struggle with that. The everyday choices that you make don't always match up to the expectations you set for yourself.
My guests are filmmakers Sierra Pettengill and Jamila Wignott. Their film Town Hall will be screened on November 17th and the 20th at the IFC Center, part of a documentary series that is a festival that's being shown there. Well, Katie ends up getting a job with Americans for Prosperity, the $40 million foundation, but you don't give any indication in the film that that organization is funded by the Koch brothers.
Yes.
isn't that an important thing to know, because this she is presenting herself as a grassroots person, and Americans for Prosperity is not really a grassroots organization. Does she think of herself as working for some small town organization?
We talked about that, how to include that in the film a lot, and we settled on, there's a card in that section that says that it's one of the best funded political action organizations in the country. Which we thought would at least sort of move towards the amount of money that's being put into it. She doesn't have a problem with it.
But does she see herself as being part of a grassroots movement, even though
I think that
she's getting a paycheck from two very famous billionaires?
She does, and I don't think for conservatives, it's just a theory, I don't think there's the same sort of contradiction in taking money from corporate entities, because it's they are sort of seen as saviors in some degree, so that they are less bothered by having corporate or a large funder infiltrating a grassroots movement. It's sort of less dangerous than the left would obviously see it as being.
I also think that Katie really identifies herself as a grassroots activist in terms of the actions she does each day, which is very, I mean, she's going to these very small, you know, community organized events. Of course, there's sponsorship in terms of the, you know, sort of the stationery that's there or the ability to rent out a hall or, you know, there's things like that that are not taking quite the same amount of, you know, that require some sort of funding. But I think in terms of the day-to-day work that she does, that's how she sort of identifies herself as that. I will say, I think over the course of filming with her, you know, I think that notion of grassroots sort of impetus became less important to the Tea Party.
The question many people have asked is how much influence do these top-down advocacy groups like FreedomWorks or America's for Prosperity have on the smaller Tea Party groups of the sort that John heads? There's John Stahl, also another Tea Party activist in your film. He points out that his local Tea Party group is the same group. He calls another group the Redneck Group. So there's
right.
even the infighting within these groups?
Yeah. Go back for a second. We were, I think, less interested in sort of the larger picture as to where money, tracking the flow of money and influence. We were trying to keep the story as small as possible and see how these two people changed over time and what they were deriving from that. But yeah, there's a lot of very colorful local infighting and the Tea Party is not a very coherent thing at all times.
And right. then there are people who wear Revolutionary War garb. Some call Obama a Kenyan socialist. And some critics have charged that the Tea Party movement has a racist side to it. And what angers them is that there's an African-American in the White House. Did you come across any of that?
I mean, I think the thing to remember is that how large an umbrella the Tea Party movement really is. So it encompasses all of these kinds of thoughts. I mean, our first research trip we took, actually, a woman approached me. This was when the Tea Party was being criticized for being racist. And she approached me at the coffee table and said, you know, do you think we're racist? And I said to her, listen, I think the Tea Party is like America. There's probably some racists in your group. And there's probably some people who are here for different reasons. So there is that element there. Again, I think that what you see in terms of Obama is he is the ultimate symbol of the kind of transformation that the United States has undergone in these, you know, past 10 years.
Well, they weren't all that happy that Mitt Romney wound up being the candidate. Who would they have liked to have seen, did they say?
Oof.
That sort of changed as the political winds changed. John was initially very into Donald Trump, and Katie liked Rick Santorum, Pennsylvania.
Lebanon and Berks County, Pennsylvania, are conservative towns surrounded by heavily Republican districts. Why were they working so hard? Aren't they already preaching to the choir here?
Actually, Redding, where John is from, is very Democratic. It's in Berks County, but it's a Democratic city, and it was actually the poorest city in America at the time that we were shooting in 2011. And his notion of racism, I mean, there are several scenes in the film that are pretty difficult to watch. One where he's giving us a tour of Reading and talking about how immigrants have sort of ruined the city, and another one on Election Day when he's, harassing Latino voters in the polling places. And, the way that we talk about race in this country on both sides is sort of missing each other. So it's not Obama is an African American, therefore we hate him and that's the end of the story. It's this very complicated, like Jamil said, he's a symbol for larger changes, and John can see those changes very potently right in front of his face in his town. So,
well, there is a chilling moment in the film where Katie and a friend attend one of the televised Republican candidate debates, the one in which Ron Paul was asked if he'd be willing to have someone who's uninsured die because he couldn't afford to pay his medical bills, and someone in the audience yelled out, "Let him die." And that was something that Katie and her friend discussed later, and the friend said, well, if somebody chose not to have insurance, let him die.
Right. And I think, you know, I think, again, that gets back to this myth of the you know, the individual. I mean, this is an American myth that goes back to the time of our founding. I mean, we'd all love to think, or some section of us loves to think of ourselves as being these kind of frontier pioneers who can do for ourselves. And I think within, especially the conservative, you know, and libertarian strains of the Republican Party, you will see people who feel very adamantly that they can and everyone should be able to sort of do for themselves.
Now, we have very little time, but I know you've been doing Q&As during screenings. What has been the general response? Did it matter where you showed the film?
Well, I mean, we've been mostly screening the film at film festivals, which tend to be a rather liberal bunch. But people are really respectful and receptive. You know, someone when we screened in Seattle, a fellow filmmaker said to us afterwards, because our Q&As tend to go on for a really long time and people really want to they really want to try to sort of heal the country and figure out how we can have a conversation. And he said to us, you know, it's funny, you guys are actually being avatars for conservatives, which is a very odd position to find yourself in trying to stand in for conservatives because that national conversation is lacking.
Well, by presenting somebody's point of view, you're not necessarily endorsing that point of view one way or the other.
Right, right.
The film is called Town Hall, and it will play November 17th and 20th at the IFC Center as part of the Doc NYC Festival. You can find tickets at ifccenter.com. And my great thanks to Sierra Pettengill and Jamila Wignott, who filmed it and directed it and edited it. And what else did you do?
Oh, no, we didn't edit it. Cindy Lee gets all the credit for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you,
Leonard. Thank you so much.